does make its way through the canopy is unlikely to pool or run directly off into storm drains.
If we have a tree, we typically have...
I'm Kiana.
I'm Tanasia.
I'm Lila.
And I'm Badilla. And we're
the Perfect 10 After School. And we love to be a part of WGXC Acra 90.7 FM, celebrating creative community radio for Greene and Columbia counties.
Cap District, what's going on? It's your main man, DJ Ketchup, and I'm here to let you know. Coming to Hudson Hall Saturday, February 8th, is Hudson's biggest night of fashion. It's the second annual Forever Young Fashion Show, and it's featuring 7-plus local designers, boutiques, 50-plus models, dance performances, DJs, pop-up shops, and more. This is all presented by Stitch, making fashion matter. All to benefit the Greater Hudson Promise neighborhood, sponsored by Columbia Memorial Health and Kohl's. All produced by Hudson's own Mel Mayus. Tickets are on sale now at StitchedNY.com. That is StitchedNY.com. We totally catch up.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Tom Daggett of Denver, Colorado. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Hi, I'm Andy Reid.
And I'm Mike Porter.
You're listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations on WGXC Acre 90.7 FM.
On each show, invited guests will be asked to discuss a number of items that they intend taking with them on their Catskill Cabin getaway. As we discuss their chosen items, it is hoped that you, the listener, will enjoy getting to know that person a little bit better.
We enjoy examining history on Catskill Cabin Conversations and wanted to begin periodically incorporating notable individuals from the history of the Hudson Valley and surrounding areas as an alternative to live guests. As we discuss what items and songs we believe that historical figure would take on a Catskill Cabin getaway, we hope that you get to know that person a little bit better.
Today's guest is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. FDR was born January 30th, 1882, in Hyde Park, New York. He was tutored at home until he attended Groton School in Groton, Massachusetts, Harvard University, and Columbia Law School. He married Anna Eleanor Roosevelt, his fifth cousin once removed, in New York City, and had five children. FDR was a New York State Senator, Assistant Secretary of the Navy. He founded the Warm Springs, Georgia Foundation. He was a two-term governor of the state of New York, and four-term president of the United States. Guiding the nation through the Great Depression and World War II were among his greatest accomplishments. He died April 12th, 1945. Mr. President, welcome to the show.
Yes, welcome to the show, Mr. President.
Boy, it'd be cool to interview FDR.
It would. I wonder how many cigarettes he would smoke in between our interviews.
I think he had one of those weird cigarette extender things, didn't he? Like Cruella de Vil. I wonder what the deal was with that.
I don't know, but apparently he smoked about 40, 50 cigarettes a day.
But that wasn't what got him, I don't think. Maybe it was.
Well, he went for some checkups, and they said that his blood pressure was really high. And
yes.
Well, being the President of the United States will do that to you. And it like carotid artery problems and onset heart disease and stuff like that.
I think he had a really massively enlarged heart.
Yeah.
Toward the end of his life. And you're right, you know, the presidency was a huge source of stress, all the travel, particularly dealing with World War II,
yeah.
And I think that really got him. And I suppose maybe polio had some part to play, and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's when I was reading about him, one of the questions I did ask myself was, why do you think he ran for the fourth term? Do you think at that point he knew, I might not make this because my health's failing, maybe I should just let somebody else do it?
You know, I was watching Ken Burns,
mm-hmm.
The Roosevelts, and I think I saw the whole series, maybe it was last year, and if I remember correctly, he didn't really run. He basically was chosen by
the convention.
By the convention.
Yeah.
And people knew, I think, that he was getting old. And pictures, they were kind of careful. The press and the Democratic Party and the Roosevelt administration, they were careful about the pictures of him that were shown to the public. There's one picture in particular that the documentary mentions where he looks very gaunt. He looks very sick. He has mm-hmm. kind of mm-hmm. an absent look in his face, not because he had like any sort of intellectual disability or decline necessarily. His body was just
declining in health
and failing.
Yeah.
And they were like, "Do not publish that picture."
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was just kind of the guy to go to. And you know, Abraham Lincoln was asked in the election of 1864, you know, "Mr. President, do you really think that you are the best guy for the job? The best candidate to be president of the United States?" And this is at the end of the Civil War, but the end was still, you know, a year away.
Mm-hmm.
And Lincoln said, "Well, you know, I don't know if I am the best guy for the job, but what I do know is that it is not wise to swap horses in the middle of a river." And, you know, FDR, figuratively speaking, the river was the Great Depression to start, the yep. Dust Bowl, World War II, and it's hard to change up your leadership when you're in the middle of something like that.
Well, why do you think America has decided that each president going forward beyond FDR
yeah.
only wanted a president to serve a maximum of two terms?
It was, I think, a precedent, a tradition set by George Washington that served us really, really well. Historically speaking, it seems, when you have government or authority that can be concentrated in the hands of a single person, inevitably you get a strong charismatic figure who occupies an office and they just stay there. And that hadn't happened. We'd had great success with that until FDR. And I think, you know, FDR is also the president at a time elected four terms. This is a time also where fascism is on the rise in Europe and throughout the world. And after we're through it, we're through World War II, fascism is defeated. Looking back, there were elements of that in the United States. And sometimes it's like, you know, there were the reasons for it. There were the reasons FDR was elected four times. But through it all, it's not good and healthy in a democracy to have a single leader in that type of position for that long. I think that's why. 22nd Amendment, two-term presidency.
Yeah, I mean, I've experienced growing up in my life, you know, there are terms in Britain, you know, that each government, you know, obviously there can be emergency elections and stuff, but in the main, yeah. an election term is 5 years. But a prime minister can be elected numerous times. Yeah. One example being in the near history is Margaret Thatcher.
Yes.
Margaret Thatcher was in power from some, I think it was 1987 until 1998 or something. But she was elected 3-4 times, and you know, the working class, most of the working class, especially in Scotland and Wales and, you know, like the Rhondda Valley and Wales and stuff, you know, hated Margaret Thatcher with a passion.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm wondering if that situation served Britain well. We're in a situation now where Scotland is knocking at the door of independence. And I can't help think that having somebody who's loathed by the majority of Scotland in power for such a long time didn't serve people's interests in terms of, you know, what they got out of the lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, scars run deep.
Yes. You don't want too much change, right? You don't want a new president necessarily every 4 years, a new prime minister every 4 years, but you don't want them around too long either. It's about finding that balance.
Now, have you been in his house, Mike?
I have.
What did you think?
I was surprised at how quaint it was, how relatively modest it was for how wealthy their family was.
Yeah, me too. I thought it was quite small.
Yes.
It's, you know, like the rooms farmhouse. Were small and,
yeah,
you know.
I mean, certainly it's a huge house by middle-class standards, but it's not like the Vanderbilt mansion. It's not like Bolt Castle in the Thousand Islands. Mm. You know, for such a wealthy family, it's nowhere on that level.
But what intrigued me was that the Queen has stayed there.
Yeah.
And one of his great friends, Churchill, stayed there. You know, and when I was looking in the rooms, I was thinking, wow, the Queen stayed in this room, you know, and her husband, Philip, stayed in that room, you know. Churchill probably sat in here and smoked his big cigars, and you know, then slept in this tiny room, you know.
And it really is like a sleepover.
Yeah.
You know, if I remember his mansion, it's not like come stay at my house, and my house is actually like a hotel resort, you know.
Yeah.
It's sort of like come stay at my house. The Queen is sleeping at your house, which is a surreal, weird thing.
Yep.
So,
yeah.
But, yeah, and I don't know, did you see any there's a lot of artifacts in there, in his living room especially, if I remember.
When I was there, it was Christmas 1 year.
Oh, nice.
And they'd set it up like Christmas, with Christmas presents and big tree and all that. But I really especially enjoyed the living room.
Yeah.
You know, the what would you call it, the lounge.
Yeah.
I thought it was very homely.
And did you see any artifacts, any toys, any models, anything like that you remember?
Well, I know he was into jigsaws, and he was into stamp collections. I know that when he was afflicted with polio, and that was one of the things that kept him, you know, focused and from depression, was his things like his stamp collection and jigsaws and stuff like that. So
yeah. And your first item is going to be the jigsaw of the USS Greer.
Yes.
That FDR would be bringing on his Catskill Cabin getaway.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways you could call it macabre, in respect that it's a jigsaw of one of the, well, the first ship that, American ship that was hit by the Germans in the Second World War. And you could say, well, why would they want to be reminded of such a travesty? But as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, he loved the Navy, and he played a big part in the U.S. Navy.
Assistant Secretary of the Navy.
Yeah.
Just like his cousin Teddy Roosevelt.
And I think the seas, and I think America overcoming the Germans and the Italians in the Second World War meant a lot to him. And this actual incident, the Greer incident, I think that kicked off things for America in a very particular way they began to give huge amount of financial assistance and started protecting, you know, the interests of the allies.
Yes. Beginning to abandon neutrality.
Yeah, and I think that this jigsaw puzzle would be a reminder of what was to come and how he played a fantastic part in overcoming the access of evil during the Second World War.
Yeah, and you're right. He did have an affinity for the Navy, for sailing, for boating. He spent, when he had first contracted polio, time on a houseboat, kind of a little more solitary.
Mm-hmm.
And the day he...
Almost like a convalescence.
Yeah, and the day he got polio, he was at camp, I believe, with his family, and they had gone out on a boat, and they had seen a little fire on an island and put it out, and he came home and said he felt weird. Just limbs felt weird, his body. And so he went to bed, and when he woke up...
He couldn't walk.
Yeah, he couldn't get his legs to move. And such a bizarre thing, polio, this virus attacks. And there's no rhyme or reason as far as doctors could really tell.
One of the things that there were specialists were suggesting was that there's a possibility it wasn't polio. It was Guillain-Barr syndrome.
Oh, okay.
However, it's been concluded that even if it was Guillain, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Guillain-Barr syndrome, even if it was the treatments at the time wouldn't have been any different, and it wouldn't have made any difference to the conclusion of his physicality.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, terrible.
So anyway, so I wanted my first item for FDR to be a jigsaw. I think he's a man who values his solitude,
yeah,
and he's very comfortable with his own self. And I think he would enjoy the pleasure of just sitting, maybe with a wee glass of wine, a cigarette, and doing the jigsaw.
And
jigsaws come in all shapes and sizes, Mike.
Okay.
So what type of jigsaw would it be? Would it be a 500 piece? Would it be a 1,000 piece? Would it be a 10,000 piece?
FDR, he would probably go for... 1,000. I didn't. There are 10,000 piece jigsaw puzzles.
Yes. Did you know that?
I did not know that. That's
right,
insane.
I'm going to read a few tidbits about jigsaws so that you can get a bigger, deeper appreciation of jigsaws.
Okay.
Now, the EDCA, I don't know if I'm EDUCA or EDUCA company of Spain, has the distinction of producing some of the smallest as well as some of the largest commercially owned or made jigsaws. The jigsaw, they've made one called the Great Challenge, and it was released in 2007. It measures 15 feet by 5 feet and contains 24,000 pieces.
That's insane.
That is insane.
What is it an image of? Anything?
Life. The Great Challenge is what it was called. There was a picture, but I've not got the picture.
Yeah, it takes your entire life to figure the thing out if you're lucky.
Now, craftsmen are constantly developing ways that this is going to intrigue you. Now, craftsmen are constantly developing ways to make it more difficult for some jigsaws, to solve jigsaws. Innovations include the phony corner.
Oh, yes, yes. I think I've seen those,
right,
in a couple of puzzles that we've done.
A fake corner... the ones we've done. A fake corner piece in the middle of the puzzle.
Wow.
Right? And colour line cutting.
Hmm.
And what that means is a piece cut exactly along the dividing line between different colours.
Yes.
So a pure green piece can then... join a pure blue piece, and neither piece gives a clue as to the color of its neighbor.
Yes. Brutal.
Yeah. Terrible.
We like Norman Rockwell puzzles. I like to do those.
Yeah.
And the
you gave me one for Christmas.
Yeah. And Thomas Kincaid.
Yeah.
Thomas Kincaid puzzles. Those are nice.
Now, I am going to be going up to the Adirondacks into somebody's cabin shortly.
That's correct.
Will there be a jigsaw there?
Indeed, there will.
Ah, cool. Now, one more piece of tidbit for the jigsaws.
Yeah.
The most pieces ever assembled together in a single jigsaw was... Do you want to take a guess?
30,000 pieces.
30,000?
Yeah.
209,250 at the Grand Formosa Regent Hotel in Taiwan.
That's insane.
I can't even conceptualize that.
No, I don't. It's beyond. I mean, I suppose you could take a gigantic painting or picture and just give a guy a scalpel and tell him to go to town and cut it up into little pieces and just keep it there.
It actually takes a long time to make a jigsaw. Now, I'm going to tell you this. Right, here's something that's quite interesting.
Yeah.
Although it may seem odd, it will take you about four times as long to do a 1,000-piece jigsaw as it will to do a 500-piece jigsaw.
Yeah.
Right? This is because each time you double the number of pieces, you quadruple the difficulty.
Yes.
Before you start a 4,000-piece jigsaw, bear in mind that it will take you 64 times longer to complete in order to complete it than it does to do a 500-piece one.
Yeah. No, it's not practical.
So can you imagine trying to do a 209,000-piece? That would take you years.
No, you can't. You would take an unbelievable, because really to start, it's just basically, I have a piece. I am going to compare it to all other pieces that could remotely match, making sure that they're not flipped over or under a cup of coffee.
So what's your strategy when you start?
Start with the edges.
Right, so the perimeter.
Start with the perimeter, and then focus on any colors that are similar, any parts of the picture that they can be identified that way, and then just piece it together.
Yeah,
do little blocks and piece it together.
When I was ill recently, somebody, I think it was Julia, bought me this jigsaw, and it was the 80s. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, we just started. It was one of those ones I'd walk by it and put a couple of bits in, and then it became a mission, you know. And at the end, I was, I'm not leaving this chair until I finish this. and then I finished it, and it was like silence, nothingness. I was like, that's it. It was this, you know, all encompassing for me to finish this, and then I finished it, nothing.
You didn't feel euphoria?
Well, for about 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And that was it. Then the hardest part of the whole thing was breaking it up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Dismantling it.
All that time, all that work.
Now, my first song, Mike.
Yes.
That I'm going to pick for FDR is a song by Rod Stewart, and I know I've been talking about his love of the aviation. No aviation. The sea. I've decided to pick a Rod Stewart song called Sailing as FDR's first song. I think he would appreciate that.
And what? And simply because of the sailing theme?
Yeah, purely because he loves the sea, and it's played a very significant part in his life.
High clouds to
it was Sailing by Rod Stewart. Now, Mike, did you know that that song was not composed by Rod Stewart?
I did not know that. Who composed it?
That was composed by Gavin Sutherland of the Sutherland Brothers in 1972. But it was best known as a 1975 international hit for Rod Stewart. So there you go, a little bit of trivia, if you like.
Interesting.
So, yeah, it was written by Gavin Sutherland. But despite that, fantastic. They recorded the song first, but Rod Stewart heard it and wanted to record it. And, you know, he knew the Gavin brothers, or the Sutherland brothers, rather. So it's not like he stole it or anything. It was, you know, it was consented that he recorded the song.
You know, Andy, you remind me, during the Great Depression, America was on its knees financially, economically.
Yeah.
And FDR comes to the forefront, Democratic nominee for the presidency. And in his acceptance speech for the nomination, he pledges to the American people a new deal. Mm-hmm. And much like Rod Stewart borrowed this song, FDR borrowed that term from one of his favorite authors, Mark Twain.
Ah.
Years ago, during the summer, I had been trying to read some Mark Twain, because it's great.
Right.
And I read a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. And I came across this passage where in the book it says, here I was in a country. And by the way, the premise of the book is that this engineer from Connecticut in the late 1800s, he's hit on the head, and when he comes to, he's in King Arthur, England. And, of course, there's no explanation as to how that came to be, but that's not the point. It's a book, it's a satire of feudalism, monarchy. It celebrates ingenuity, democratic values. It questions capitalism and the consequences of the Industrial Revolution. But in the book, I'm reading this in really brilliant observations by Mark Twain, and, you know, not only just talking about feudal Europe, but also comparing it to America and what America was becoming and how similar the Gilded Age was to feudal Europe. You know, is Vanderbilt or Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, are they really all that different from a king or a queen or a duke? And he says in the book, here I was in a country where a right to say how the country should be governed was restricted to 6 persons in each 1,000 of its population. I was become a stockholder in a corporation where 994 of the members furnished all the money and did all the work, and the other 6 elected themselves a permanent board of direction and took all the dividends. It seemed to me that what the 994 dupes needed was a new deal. And when I read that, I was like, oh my gosh, that's just like, and that is in fact where FDR got the inspiration for the term, for that domestic program, which did not end the Great Depression, but it helped America to know that people cared about them.
I think what he did do was he steered America in a different path.
Oh yeah.
So that in itself was fundamental to the direction of the United States. Now, sadly, I would say we need a new deal today.
Mm.
You know, if you look at the taxation on the rich compared to the middle classes or the poor, we're still no better position than we were 100 years ago.
Yeah. Well, there's a vast disparity in wealth. There are 26 people on the planet that have as much wealth as half the planet's population.
And that's just gross.
Yeah, well, it's unfathomable for one. That 26 and 3.6 billion are the same in terms of wealth. And it's also, I mean, not only probably unethical and immoral, unless you're an Ayn Rand kind of thinker, but it's just not healthy for society to concentrate wealth that much. I mean, the middle class is what drives the economy. And if wealth is being siphoned from the middle class and also the poor, you just don't have as much money to buy stuff, and it has a slowing effect. But anyway, the thing about FDR he gets that nomination, and his campaign's theme song is Happy Days Are Here Again. And I thought that that would be Mark Twain on his Catskill Cabin getaway. He would bring a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court to remind him, you know, it's one of his favorite books. Mark Twain's one of his favorite authors. Remind him of the New Deal, his approach to the Great Depression. And while he's reading that, he would throw on a record, and it would be Happy Days Are Here Again.
Happy Days Are Here Again by Ian Whitcomb and his dance band. Good choice, Mike.
Thank you.
I really do think FDR would enjoy sitting listening to that. That would bring back some really heartwarming memories for him.
You were saying over the break or during the song there, and I think you're right. Any successful campaign needs a song. It needs a catchphrase.
Yes, we can.
That's right. You know.
You know. I remember when Tony Blair and the Labour Party get in and a landslide victory in Britain, and they had a song, "Things Can Only Get Better," and yeah. It was a hit from a band a few years earlier, and that song was played at every conference and every opportunity. That song was emblazoned on buses and everything. Things Can Only Get Better.
Wow.
And you know, one of the most important things in a campaign is a slogan.
Yes.
Make America great again.
It's catchy. Now, your next item, a stamp collection.
Yes. Did you know that FDR was a philatelist?
And what is a philatelist?
A philatelist is a stamp collector. Tomato, you know, tomato.
I was never interested in stamps.
No?
If anything, I find them annoying.
Why?
Because I need them to mail things, which I don't enjoy. They cost money, and they're just these little kind of piddly pieces of paper that you have to stick on something. It's an extra menial task on top of an already menial task that you're usually sending a bill. Right, it's usually not for something fun, like a birthday card or something, especially nowadays where a lot of that stuff is done digitally. And
you know, it's the cost of the stamp doesn't... you're basically just paying for the right for somebody to send it for you, because the stamp is only going to cost fractions of a pence to manufacture.
Right, yes.
However, there's some interesting things about stamps and stamp collections. Now, you were talking earlier about the writer, what do you call him?
Mark Twain.
Did you know that the great writer William Shakespeare was the first person to appear on a UK postal stamp who wasn't from the royal family?
I did not know that.
Yeah. So usually it's just the royal family.
Yeah.
But he was the first person who wasn't a member of the royal family.
Shakespeare.
Now, in 1993, the Elvis Presley stamp became the most popular US stamp sold. How many estimated copies were sold?
50 million.
50 million, you
yes.
say? 120 million. So there you are.
Well, that was in the ballpark of numbers. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I mean, at least you were in the millions.
It wasn't a billion.
Hundreds
it wasn't
of thousands.
A thousand. You know, so.
Now, the first postal stamp... first postal stamps were not able to be stuck to the envelopes.
Oh.
People had to literally sew the stamps on when no paste or adhesive was available.
That's annoying.
So you think you're hard done by now? People had to sew their stamps on.
Sorry, nobody's getting letters from me.
But here's the best stamp of all.
Yeah.
In 2013, the Belgians printed postal stamps that tasted and smelled like chocolate.
Ooh, now that's an idea. Why do we not do that? Scratch and sniff stamps that taste good. It would make the whole letter mailing thing far more pleasurable.
Well, and prior to this, they invented in the late 19th century, they trained about 37 cats to deliver letters in villages, only to discontinue it because they couldn't totally be confident that the cats would comply.
Meow. Hey, how's Ruby doing?
Ruby's fine.
Ruby the kitty.
Ruby's fine. He's staying with Kelly in Hudson now.
Ah.
And Lucy's fine as well.
Yeah, Lucy the kitty.
She's, well, she owns me.
Yeah.
So I don't own her.
I remember there was that time you were abroad, I believe. And I mean... in another country, not a woman.
Yeah.
And I went over to your place to check on little Ruby. And in her loneliness, she decided to drape herself across the back of my neck like a kitty scarf. And it was adorable and also a little scary because she is a miniature lion or a tiger or something. I don't know. So
yeah, she is.
And I've seen her attack you. And so I didn't, you know.
was like, okay, this is cute, but a little unsettling.
Yes, please
dangerously
stop
close
now.
To me. Yeah, dangerously close to some of the vitals.
Actually, I was scratched this morning by Lucy.
Really?
She hid behind a net curtain, and I went over and I was, she scratched me.
Why'd
she caught me.
It?
She caught me with her claw. That was my fault. So.
Yep.
Anyway, now, Mike, your next item that you would like FDR to take with him on his Catskill Cabin conversation is a bed tray.
Bed tray. FDR was a man of routine. And this wasn't necessarily of his own volition. Is that the word?
Yeah.
It wasn't his choice. He grew up, his mom was a very strict woman that kept him on a strict schedule. And even when he was sick with polio, he had to stick to a strict schedule. Breakfast on a bed tray, up and dressed by 10, lunch with mother at 1, nap, tea at 4, dinner at 7, bed by 11.
And then repeat.
And repeat. And this is a grown man with a wife and 5 children whose schedule is being dictated by his mother.
Wow.
I have heard his mother basically ran his finances while he was president of the United States. She died in 1941. He died in 1945, just 3.5 years later. So the vast majority of his entire life, he was really kind of dominated by his mom. Her wedding present to him and Eleanor was like a townhouse in New York City that was directly connected to her townhouse with a door on each floor between the two.
Wow.
So she could just walk in on any floor at any time.
Do you think that's one of the reasons why Eleanor moved to Valkill?
To a degree. There were these... Eleanor was always... Let's see. She wanted FDR to... I've gotten it mixed. I can't remember. His wife wanted him to rest, and his mom wanted him to work. Or vice versa. When he was stricken with polio, you know, he had to do these exercises. And so he's being kind of nagged, coached. He's being coerced into either activity or inactivity by these two powerful women in his life. And, you know, it's conflicting messages. They both want him to do different things, and so he can't really win.
Yeah.
And, so Eleanor had went for a time and took the kids and...
Well, I think there was, we kind of alluded to it earlier, but he did have some affairs, extramarital affairs. And, at that time, was pretty unheard of, but it was less so then. And, especially for a president of the United States, it wasn't something that was publicized at all. And, I think, like, any woman who would be married and in love would take it hard,
Oh, yeah. So. And Eleanor, she really had it rough. She was never a very, like, pretty girl, most people would say. And even her mother. I think it was her mother that had a nickname for Eleanor, and she called her, like, the little granny when she was a little kid. and that stuck with her. That hurt. And she had to kind of deal with that baggage her entire life. She's a really kind of a tragic figure who, the thing with them, though, is these Roosevelts, they come into great wealth. They're born into greatness. But it was not easy. Every day for these folks, for one reason or another, was a battle. Hmm. And whether it's dealing with depression or family and the hurt or disease or death or loss, it wasn't easy for these folks.
And pressure of, the presidency, not just the presidency, other positions of high importance prior to being the president. And being the partner of somebody who's, that's their life.
And one of the things I think that made Roosevelt a great president is the dude always had a smile. And this was, he was kind of a puzzle to people, but he was in pain a lot of the time because of polio, and his muscles hurt, and it was really painful for him to stand, and he would stand and give speeches and have a big smile on his face, and no one really truly understood what was going on in there.
Yeah.
And but if he had been any other way, he might not have been so politically successful.
Yeah, agreed.
Andy, your next song that FDR take would take on his Catskill Cabin getaway is Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick by Ian Dury and the Blackheads.
Now, my first thought about this song, I kind of hesitated. And the reason I hesitated was because I didn't want to come across as being flippant by choosing this song. But I decided to put it in anyway because the main guy... Now, I regard this guy, Ian Dury, as one of my favourite frontmen of all time. Second only to Freddie Mercury in my eyes. Now, Ian Dury was afflicted by polio. But what a frontman he was. He was so large, such a powerful personality, and was regarded in rock circles in Britain in the 70s and 80s as a powerful and fantastic frontman. But as I said, he was afflicted by polio. Now, you mentioned earlier that FDR was on the boat or he was in the sea when he at the end of the day didn't he feel well yes. and stuff like that. Now, Ian Dury was 7 and contracted polio, most likely, he believed, from a swimming pool.
Yes.
At Southend-on-Sea during the 1949 polio epidemic in Britain. Now, I know that's after a period when FDR had died, but maybe the polio epidemic hadn't hit British shores by then.
Yeah.
After 6 weeks in a full plaster cast, which, you know, a cast in the Royal Cornwall Infirmary, he was moved back to Black Notley Hospital in Braintree in Essex, where he spent a year and a half before going to Chainley Heritage Craft School, Essex, in 1951. His illness resulted in the paralysis and withering of his left leg, shoulder and arm. And I'm sure this happened to countless people around about that time. But he was treated poorly. He was treated as someone who had, you know, handicap and, you know, was treated badly in schools that he grew up in and stuff like that. As a result, he left school at 16 and became a, you know, it was very interesting, art and stuff like that. And became an artist and went on to be, you know, be known for his greatness as a musician, frontman. But that's the reason why I chose this song, not because of the song in particular, because of who he was. And I think FDR would have looked at this guy with such admiration for what he achieved, for how much respect he had garnered from the British public over the years, and I think he would have had a special place in FDR's heart for what he did.
Yeah. In the deserts of Sudan, the gardens of Japan, from Milan to Yucatan, every woman's, every man. Hit me with your rhythm stick, hit me, hit me, je t'adore, ich liebe dich. Hit me, hit me, hit me, hit me with your rhythm stick, hit me slowly, hit me quick, hit me. Stick. It's nice to be a lunatic. Hit me, hit me. hit me, hit me.
The fantastic Ian Dury and the Blockheads with Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick. Love that guy.
Yeah. Catskill Cabin Conversations is on WGXC. This is community radio. If you can donate at any time, please go to WGXC.org. Become a sustaining member. Just a little bit every month would help to keep shows like Catskill Cabin Conversations going.
Yeah, very important. Thank you. Now, Mike, we're running out of time.
Yes.
So we need to go straight to your last song. What is it?
One of FDR's favorite songs was Home on the Range, and I have it here sung by Gene Autry. It's a classic Western folk song poem. The lyrics were written in 1871 by Dr. Brewster M. Higley, and his friend Daniel E. Kelly wrote the melody on guitar. And it reminds me, you know, Home on the Range, being out on the prairie in Kansas. That's where the Dust Bowl hit. And I thought today, in anticipation of our conversation about with FDR, we would talk a lot about World War II. We'd talk a lot about the Depression. And as though those two great calamities weren't enough, there also happened to be this kind of natural disaster where you have the Dust Bowl, and the whole Midwest is covered in dust and all the horror that went with that. And it got me thinking about that generation and how they're called the greatest generation. And we're running low on time, so I guess we can't get into a critical historical conversation arguing, you know, but were they truly the greatest generation? Point one of 17. But these were amazing people. And so I thought that was a fitting way to wrap it up. Take an FDR, Home on the Range.
Oh, give me a home where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are are not cloudy all day. How often at night, when the heavens are bright, with the light from the glittering stars, have I stood there amazed and asked as I gaze if their glory exceeds that of ours. Home, home on the range, where the deer seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day.
That was Home on the Range by
Gene Autry. Yeah.